It doesn't, I'm not shocked by it, or not that I live in disbelief of synchronicity. It's exactly what I live in belief of. But it's just always so charming when it works. And I mean that when you see it right out in front of you, just how absolutely perfect the world is. So I had an experience like this with Eugene the other night, which just, I asked before I started the talk at East West for an answer to a question that I've been thinking about for a few months. And it really had to do with whether I should continue speaking at East West or not. And the minute the talk was over, she came right up to me and answered the question. I hadn't seen her in over a year. I sort of had that feeling like I had with a couple of you, like I'd seen this person before, but and she just answered the question. It's like Divine Mother working right through her. Yesterday morning, we have a huge event going on out at our farm today, and another big play going on. And I looked at Chandra and I said, no, there are more people wanting to come here this morning. I know that. So I said, let's send an email out and just say this class is happening, which we almost would never do the day before. I mean, it's 3 hours of a Saturday. It's a big chunk of time. And I think many of you are here because that email went out. Just kind of interesting. So it's really beautiful to have that experience. So almost all of you know me. I'm Shanti Rubenstone. For the few of you who don't, I just mentioned to you that obviously I'm involved with Ananda, which is why the class is here. I'm one of the ministers. I'm the manager of the church. I do a lot of teaching here. And then you'll hear as my stories unfold that I'm also a physician. And I've been in medicine for years, of course. And I was sent into medicine, those of you who know this already, just bear with me for a moment, because it's so meaningful. Many of the stories that I wind up telling, I don't know what they're going to be, but I know that stories will come through that have to do with me being in medicine. So just in a sentence or two, I want to say that in my late 20s, when I was trying to decide whether to become a clinical psychologist or a physician, I knew I wanted to go back to school, but wasn't sure what to do. I had an experience under the Encinitas Hermitage, which is the place where Yogananda, who's the man on the bottom of all of those great saints up there, landed when he first came to the United States. It was the first place that he built, called the Encinitas Hermitage, where he kept the monks. I knew none of this at the time. I'd heard of the word saint, but I didn't know what that meant. I'd never heard the word Swami. I just wasn't there. I didn't know anything. But I started having experiences as I was running on the beach underneath the hermitage, which I would go home and share with my husband. Weird. I was thinking, boy, these strange things are happening. And one day it came to me with kind of a crystal clarity. That's all I can say. I will assume that everybody in this room has had an experience like that. Suddenly you know something. You know it beyond a shadow of a doubt. It's like somebody spoke it into your head. And it's just perfect. And you know it's perfect right from the minute you hear it. And that for me was, you're going to medical school and you will have to go to an Ivy League college because you will be teaching in unusual ways and you'll need that credibility. That's just, it came like that. I finished the run. I went home and said to my husband, who was a physician, guess what? I'm going to medical school and I have to go to an Ivy League school. And without a beat's pause, and this is true, this is not exaggeration, he said to me, okay, what do we do? It was like that. And I'm telling you this for a reason, but I am going to finish up with one little story about that. So I started looking into medical schools. I did not have a college degree. I was a nurse, and I had what was called a diploma degree. I'd gone back, taken about 2 years worth of college credits, but I didn't have a college degree. I just started applying to medical schools. I was accepted at several Ivy League medical schools, Yale, Duke, Stanford, and I wound up going to Stanford. And 3 weeks before I graduated, the Dean of Student Affairs called me in. We had become good friends. He said, "Miss Shanti, we have a problem." And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "We can't find your undergraduate degree." And I said, "I don't have one." And he said, "That is impossible." Not hyperbole. I mean, I didn't remember this story, which is really odd, until maybe 5 years ago the whole thing came back to me. Anyway, after he came out of his disbelief that somehow I'd been accepted to medical school without a degree, which is, as we all know, virtually impossible. I mean, could you imagine anybody going to law school or anywhere without graduating from college? And I thought to myself many times, what did I write in the line where it said, where did you graduate from college? And not only that, they have to collect records in those places. I mean, you can't quite wrap your mind around this. I thought, did I write not applicable or not one? So I said, well, you do have a problem, John, because I'm graduating and actually had a big role in graduation. So they gave me an honorary degree in Stanford as a Bachelor of Medical Sciences. Now, why am I telling you all this? Clearly, I had nothing to do with that. I was this naive and, I don't want to use the word stupid because I'm not stupid, but just, I was totally not plugged into that whole experience. But, you know, we call that divine intervention, grace. Call it what you want. Everything that we're going to talk about today, all of that that lives beyond the logical and rational mind. But the reason why I'm starting with it is because many of the stories are like that. And it's easy if I tell you stories about Yogananda or Jesus or Krishna or Kriyananda, who founded all of Ananda, for us to say, oh yeah, of course it happens to them. They're great saints. But it's another thing when it happens to us. And even I'm saying it because this is this strange position. I happen to be giving the class. So you could easily say, oh, that's Shanti. But it's not true. It's us. Any one of you could be teaching a class up here on anything, and I could be sitting where you are. And in fact, quite the contrary of or to this happens to her, because the reason to tell these stories is to say anything in the world that's happened to me could happen to any of us. Of course, because who am I? I mean, we're all just taking our next steps on this path, whatever we call it. I'm going to call it our spiritual path. Maybe people have never even thought of it like that. Maybe you just call it your life. But we all are where we are. We're all looking for our next step. I'm going to assume, though I don't know a lot of you, that none of us in this room is a fully realized master. I can speak for myself in that regard. But there's something about a willingness to step outside of that which we know through our rational mind. Not easy to do this, by the way, because most of us have very good minds. And then the mind does what it's supposed to do, and it gets rational and logical, which is why John Stewart, who subsequently has passed away, but he'd been the dean of the Student Affairs for many years, was incredulous. He couldn't get his mind around the fact that there was a student there who was graduating, who had done quite well, who had never graduated from college. And there was no way he was going to make sense of that. The only way to make sense of that was to give me a degree. It was sort of like closed that door. And I understand it. So I could say to you, even as I did when we first started, I'm not surprised. I've had so many miracles happen in my life now, so many of them, that long ago I just started believing that what we see is not at all what we get, you know? What we see really is merely the dream, a dream that's been made manifest through consciousness, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about this. Nothing here is real. Anything can happen, and everything can happen. The instant we know it, and I mean that, the instant we know it. So when we get into this topic of today, and we talk about what it means to realize the divine within us. Chandra, I'm so sorry to do this. Can I have a glass of water? I'm really... You know, it's right back here. The tea is just sticking in my throat. We'll talk a little bit about how consciousness manifests as us. and not just as us, but as other experiences, because that's what we're here to talk about today. We're here to talk about how this, what are the eight ways. Thank you very much. No, go. I'm okay. This is a used glass.
Is it?
No problem. You just say a little omo. My husband's crazy. My husband is meticulous, which is probably a big part of why I married him, because I'm a Virgo and I'm very ordered and organized and efficient. And, you know, wasn't hard for people to look a little slovenly to me in years past. And then I met Barry, who makes me look slovenly. The city, and they'll say, honey, you can't leave your purse sitting on the floor in the car, and you can't do this. I'm just sort of like a scatterbrained, you know, he's always surprised I'm not blonde, if you will, that whole, that's how he holds me. And I'll say, oh, come on, just say a little around the car, just ask Master to bless it. Fortunately, I haven't been proven wrong far, but anyway, so, is to realize that what we're looking at in the world really is a play of light and shadow. And I know that doesn't make a lot of sense when you first hear it. Hopefully it'll make a little more sense a couple of hours from now, because I want to talk about it a little bit. But if we're here to discover what are those ways that we can get not just focused, but allow ourselves to have an experience of the divine, that's really what we're going to talk about. These eight manifestations, that's what it means. Eight ways that, and again, if I don't know you folks, but you all came here, and you all came here, many of you, most of you, after hearing me talk. But I don't want to have to be careful about talking about God today at all, or consciousness, or the divine. If that bothers you, please fill in the blank with a word that doesn't, or a concept that doesn't. And I keep saying this in many of my classes, but all you need to do, somebody came up to Swami Kriyananda at the end of one of his talks, I think it was in Australia, and said to him, you know, well, how can I believe everything you're saying, even though he really likes Swami's talks, if I don't believe in God? And Swami said to him, why don't you just think of that as your own highest self, your own highest potential, maybe even a higher potential than you know you have. So I'm inviting you all to do that. Let's not get tripped up over words. The English language is so limited in some ways, quite frankly. If we could all just sit down and meditate together and attain some of these states, we of course wouldn't have to use any words. But we're not going to be able to do that. So for many reasons, we're not going to be able to do that. You know, we'd all have to be able to get to that point, and that might challenge some of us. So we have to use this language. So I'm going to ask you, try not to be bothered by the language, but let the feeling of the morning just run through you. Because I think that's where we can realize truth. You know, it's just like what happened to me on the beach underneath the Encinitas Hermitage. If I was trying to make that rational or sane, I would have never listened to it. I would have, you know, made a wrong turn because I was listening more to my own ego, my own desire, than inspiration, which transcends the mind and our own desire. And if I wasn't willing to hear that as inspiration, or able, I don't even know how conscious it was, you know, I could be having the worst job in the world, hating my boss, not having found the right person. That's how lives go. You know, they really do. It's just very real. And then we wonder why things aren't harmonious. Things get more harmonious the more time we spend trying to attune ourselves to that, to our own wisdom, our own inspiration, all the fact that we can know that it's completely beyond mind. When I was 50 years old, I was living on the East Coast, and I was really hating it. I did not belong there. And it came to me that if I stayed in Baltimore, that I was going to get a disease and die. I just knew it. I didn't belong there. I was just missing California so much. And so I left. I was there. I had the third largest practice in the United States, and I was teaching at Hopkins. And I had my partner, who my husband, and I was living on this place on 100 acres of land. From the outside in, it looked like the perfect life, because it was the life so many other people wanted. And I did a three-week seclusion, and I realized that during that seclusion, you have to get out of here. That's when it came to me. If you stay here, you will die. And I was so clear about it. So I went back to work, and I told my partners, I'm leaving, I'm giving you 6 months' notice. And in those 6 months, I must have been asked the question 50 times, if not hundreds. I don't want to exaggerate. Well, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to do next, Shanti? And every time it came to me, every time that question came to me, it got more and more and more clear. I don't know, and I don't want to know. I do not want to figure this out. And that's when I said, you know what? I'm going to take at least the next year of my life off. And it just blew everybody away. But it was so clear, I needed to get quiet enough that I could hear what I was supposed to do next. Now, I have a lot of words for this now. That was 17 years ago, and I've been living in the Ananda community, and, you know, I was already meditating, but I mean, deep in my meditation, living around other soul-seeking people, I've gone through a lot of lifetimes worth of stuff in 17 years. But I didn't know then what I know now, but I knew the truth. Like, we all can. We just have to get quiet and still enough to hear it. So I was a 50-year-old woman who had the third largest practice in the United States, rather sophisticated, bright enough at least, and I put everything I owned into storage and lived out of my Jetta for the next year with peanut butter and bread and soup. You know, it was not the life many people would have thought I would live. But you see, I'm telling you these stories for a reason, and as I said to you in the beginning, it's not really about me, but it was about what it means to get quiet enough and still enough to know what we're going to be talking about today. Well, I'm already talking about it. Because these eight ways that God manifests and our ability to know that is not a practice. It's not even what meditation is for most of us, which is a practice. It's not a knowing. It's not an understanding. It's an experience. And once you have the experience, then you know it without a doubt. And you don't have to have every single experience in the world to know it. If we each have to learn every single thing, I mean, instead of millions of lives to become self-realized, it would take us billions of lives. It would be an impossible task. But you have to get to that point where you have the faith and the knowing that in a place of quiet and stillness, we can know things that are virtually, and I mean that literally, impossible to know in any other way. It doesn't matter how smart we are at all. It doesn't matter how long we try and reason. It doesn't matter how many books we read, even the books of these great saints, so there's a lot of reasons to read them. None of it can really truly be known. Paramahansa Yogananda said for years, all of this can be proven in a laboratory. Don't take my word for it, he used to say. Don't take any of this on faith. It can all be proven in a laboratory. The laboratory is within each of us. Because once you have this happen, then there's no doubt in your mind. I've read so many stories by so many saints. When, again, I was just naive and ridiculous in some ways, and I know that. I'm sure I still am. I'm just not looking at my life in the moment that way. But I was searching for something in my life. So first I tried being an Orthodox Jew. That didn't work. I found little or no inspiration. Then I took two vacations a year throughout my teens and 20s, and I would go to different masters, just trying to see where I belong. And it wasn't really until I found Ananda that I found my path. This is not everybody's path, but all along I was reading these books by all these people. But the reading of the books did not give me the experience. In my late 20s, I was sitting in a workshop called Mandala Society Holistic Health Meeting. Now this was in the 70s. Nobody used those words then. I didn't know what a mandala was. I didn't really know, nobody really knew what holistic health meant. And I mean, most people still don't use the term correctly, but now it's manifested in so many ways. And Swami Satchitananda was the sort of the token saint, if you will. He was a true saint. He subsequently died, but he's the man who started the Integral Yoga Institute. Anyway, a truly enlightened being. And well, it just changed my life listening to him. And when I went from that workshop, I was taking some undergraduate courses at UCSD. I had this experience for 3 months that I wouldn't have had words to, but everything I saw in the world was love. I was like a flower child, but it was a little late, you know. I was in love with everybody and everything. I was listening about a week ago to a talk that I'd given some time ago, and I told this story, which is why it's in my mind, that my husband used to come to school with me because he was afraid of what I would do. It was a weird thing. He was just like watching me. Who is this woman who was just living in love? And 3 months later, it was taken from me. 3 months to the day of that conference, it's like I awakened to myself. Oh, it was profoundly disappointing. I mean, it could bring tears to my eyes now. I cried for days. You know, I'm a big, I had this huge ego. I was, you know, an East Coast Jewish woman. It was all right there again. But I had had the experience. I knew what was possible. And I have been so grateful ever since then. Because once you have it, then you know. And don't fool yourself. Don't say, oh, I did it this once, and yeah, I'll come to another class. No, then you say to yourself, this is what I want. This is what I will spend my life looking for. I've never gotten back there. I've had some wonderful moments in meditation. A lot of nice things have happened, wonderful things. Grace has descended in moments. Not like that. But nobody's ever going to talk me out of the fact that it exists. It was as real as anything. So, we have to start with an assumption that we're all going to agree on. And I just have the ability to speak with that assumption because unless any one of you stands up and runs screaming from the room, which you might do, I've had that happen, but otherwise we'll assume that we agree, that we're starting, our starting place is with super consciousness, where all that existed was super consciousness. We call that God. Call that what you want. This pure, perfect being who lived, who was peace, who was calmness. And I say who, even still I'm anthropomorphizing it to some degree. But that state. And then, and this is important to understand because we get down sort of to where we are and then we can see what we're aiming back for. Had a thought to manifest itself. And with that thought came a vibration. And with that vibration came energy. This is so super consciousness, to thought, to vibration, to energy, and then energy that manifested in all the ways we see and that our rational mind knows. Universes, planets, trees, rocks, human beings. More subtle than that, which we all now know because the physicists tell us this now, this is for sure, our thoughts. We don't think of thoughts as things, but they are. And they're, in fact, exactly made up of exactly the same energy, exactly, as the chair you're sitting on. That's a very hard thing to get, but it is true. This is what quantum physics is. This is the essence of it, really, even though I couldn't stand up here and give a lecture on quantum physics, so don't ask too many questions, but I know that it's the essence of what it's at, is that everything is energy vibrating at different frequencies. And it's the difference in the frequency at which things vibrate that give us the illusion that we're separate. Does that make sense? Everybody, So if you knew for sure that you were vibrating at the same frequency as that chair, you couldn't sit on it. You have to manifest it as something other. It's got to be vibrating at a different frequency. You have to have that illusion that it is. Einstein said the illusion that we're separate is a delusion of our consciousness. He said that because he knew nothing was really separate. But you can't tell the mind that because it's so illogical. Nobody knows what to do with it. You can't understand that. But it is the truth. I had this very interesting experience this morning of reading a chapter in the autobiography of a yogi, which is Yogananda's big, he wrote so many books, but Autobiography of a Yogi is a true spiritual classic. And in that book called The Law of Miracles, a chapter called The Law of Miracles, he talks about this, and it's so fascinating. For a while this morning, I thought, I'm just going to read these 6 pages. But I don't know if we'll get there. We'll see. But he talks about this concept as the yogis knew it and how exciting it was for him because he died in 52. So he was here for the whole beginning of the last century to watch a lot of the scientists come and begin to be able to prove these things that the yogis have been talking about from the beginning, literally, from the very beginning, because it's the truth. And truth isn't developed or studied or doesn't come into being when somebody finally understands it. It is there, and then eventually people begin to understand it. And then sometimes somebody like Einstein can actually find a mathematical equation that proves it. I mean, we all know that now. We know that he knew energy. He knew E equals mc squared, right? He knew all about light and the velocity of light being the only constant in the universe, but it took him 10 years to find the math to prove it. It came to him in an intuitive flash. I mean, we've probably all heard that because that's sort of, I think, pretty common knowledge. But if you let it in, if you realize what that means, he knew something for sure. Then it took him 10 years to prove it. And he's written so much about the spiritual understanding of things. Well, Yogananda didn't live at a time where there was not quantum physics when Yogananda lived. He knew all this. The yogis knew all of it. He's writing about it in his book. But the idea that some of the scientists were proving it and he could write a chapter. So this man who only finished college because his guru insisted that he finish college. That's a whole other story that I won't go into, but for a lot of reasons. And probably never took a science class in his life, writes this extraordinary chapter. Even this morning I was reading it and I thought, if I want them to get everything in the chapter, I really have to read it to them because I could never understand it well enough to explain it. You know, it's physics. It's Einsteinian theories and I just can't do it. My mind just doesn't want to go there. But he could write about it. That's a miracle in and of itself, is what I'm saying. He's writing a chapter on the Law of Miracles. The fact that he could explain it the way it's explained in this book is a Law of Miracles. This whole thing about super consciousness, thought, vibration, energy, is not something that's made up in somebody's mind. This is what Einstein was saying. And this is what the other scientists at the time started seeing. Time and space, they say, don't exist. There's no such thing. They are not constant. They're relative to light. Light is the only constant. And everything had to come from that light, which we're going to call super consciousness. And it makes perfect sense, because if we say that in order to find peace, in order to be able to really find the love that we're all looking for, every one of us, we might be looking for it in different ways. You know, some people think the greatest joy in the world is a scientific discovery or finding the perfect job or having their kids get into the right college or finding the perfect mate, you know, or, I mean, it sounds silly, but it isn't. I have a friend who loves shoes. And she, honestly, I could say that maybe some of the greatest pleasure she has in life is every time she buys a new pair of shoes. If she buys shoes that she loves No shoes can cost $300. She'll buy them in $3. You know, wasn't there a song, Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places? I think it was the song, was it? Now, is anybody else in this room old enough to even remember that? I don't think so. Oh, my. Well, anyway, there was a song called Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places. But it's our lives. It's what many of us are doing. The motivator is to be able to be in love. Now, that gets mistaken in a lot of ways, and when I talk about love, I'll talk about more of it. But the point is that in order to find all of what we think we're looking for, whatever it is that motivated any one of you to come here today, it's in the answer to it is in understanding that our goal is to go from energy being made manifest, which is us, this body, the sense that we're separate, right? And all of the delusion that comes with believing, which of course we have to. We instinct the sperm and the ovum unite. So I'm not blaming anybody. I'm not saying we're fools. It's the nature of the human condition. The minute the sperm and ovum unite, the instant and that soul attaches, we're separate from the divine. That's the nature of the human condition. But somehow we live with this longing, and we get a little confused along the way about what we're longing for. And every, you know, 90% of the people in the universe, if not more, would love to help us stay in delusion. In fact, this is really weird. It just came into my mind that it's the truth. I listen to KCBS News in my car most of the time. It's just the way I hear what's going on in the world. So if you want to listen to it for even half a day, you'll hear this. There's an advertisement on right now there that is about, let me see if I can pull it up right now. It's called Karma Something. That's the name of the company. Fine. I'm not going to be able to remember what it does because it cracks me up every time I hear it, and then I just get lost in my own thoughts. But whatever the company will have you do, the way the advertisers thought was brilliant to advertise it is to have this really stupid-sounding man. Oh, yeah, I don't want to talk to you too much about karma, whatever it is. Don't listen to those ads about karma, because then you'll find out how much money they could save you, and we don't want you to know that. Why would I want you to know that? Because he wants you to buy his company. Because it's some app or something that you can get that's free. Oh, Karma Credit. Karma Credit. Have you heard, anybody else heard this? And so you can go online. I'm pretty sure it's called Karma Credit. You can find out your credit scores and your credit rating and how expensive of a house that you could buy, and it's free. So this other guy's saying, by way of selling it, don't listen to it. And, I mean, you just have to wrap your mind around the absurdity of that, but when I was listening to it, I thought, that's pretty much like what happens through our whole life. We look at billboards, we're sold on things, our friends get a beautiful home, and, I mean, how many of us grow up really consciously deciding what we want to do, consciously deciding, do I actually want to own a home? What does it mean to own a home? What comes with the house once you own it? You know? I mean, people don't even give that much thought to having a child. You know, never mind. It's like what people do. You grow up, you get married. I mean, the vast majority of people, obviously. Some of us have made some other choices, but as a rule, you know, we just live unconsciously, we're influenced, and it is the nature of the human condition. What we're all here to do is to wake up. And what does that mean, waking up? What waking up means is going in reverse. It means just going through everything I just talked about, from form to the realization. That doesn't mean the understanding, the perception, the realizing that we are pure energy. Because from there, we get to realize that we can transform that energy. Energy can always be transformed. That means we can begin to work with that energy and realize it in any form we want. And soon, we will get back into the vibration, and the vibration that we're aiming for is this still, quiet, the calmest vibration until we get to the point where there is no vibration. There is no vibration. Where nothing is vibrating is back in that superconscious state. The minute there's vibration, it means you're away from the center, no matter how slightly. We call that duality. The center is where we're all headed, we're either here or we're here. And then Newton came along and said, as far out as you are here, you've got to go the other way, right? For every reaction, there's an equal and opposite reaction. I mean, it applies, these are physical laws of the universe, they apply to everything. They apply to all energy, and everything is only energy. So it applies to everything, to every feeling that we have. So we have to begin to say, what is my goal? My goal is to have this experience of oneness. So these eight manifestations of the divine, we'll talk about each of them, or at least a few of them, we may not get to all of them, is a way that divine energy manifests on the earth in its purest form, so that if we can get ourselves into that pure form, we will know God. And we'll know God not with our mind, but with the experience of the divine, with what that experience I was given when I was 28 years old, of being in love, literally. Because when you're in those places, and they manifest in many ways, there is no opposite. If you are truly love, you don't know anger or fear. You can't. It's by its very nature, by what we're talking about, it's an experience of purity, of no vibration, of going back to our origin. Let me stop for a minute. Does anybody have any comments or questions right now? Because that's really important to understand why I even wanted to teach this class today. Okay, fair enough. Is nobody asking or saying anything because your mind's just a mess with all of it, or because it's clear? I just don't know. Or you? I didn't lose anybody. I taught a class. Were you in the class where the man stood up and walked out? This must have been 3 or 4 years ago, maybe even more. I don't think you were there. What was I teaching? Could have been a chapter. It doesn't matter what I was teaching. What difference does it make? But it was the first class, and I had to talk about reincarnation. There was just no way to give the class without setting. You know, it was a setup for every class. Like, this was just, okay, here it is. Here's where we're going to move to from here. And he said to me, and he was very smiley and warm when he came in. And the class, there must have been, it was an evening class with probably about 30 people here. And he was sitting right there. And he was just, and then he said to me, can you prove that, please? And I said, well, probably not in this class, I could tell you stories. No, can you give me scientific proof? And I just knew, right, were you here? Yeah. He was, yeah. He got so angry, and I was just calm, fortunately. And I said to him, you know, I'd be happy to meet with you after class, but this isn't, we shouldn't do this here. This isn't going to be, there's a class to be taught. And he got up and he literally stormed out of the class. Whatever I was teaching, it became a perfect example of it, though. So it was just perfect. We could just, I forget the whole story now. I think it's the only time anybody here has ever walked out. But I could understand that this is sort of out there compared to where the vast majority of people in the world live, so.
No, I was just
going to
say, I'm going to this class, and then I'm going to another one this afternoon at
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. I mean, I think many people have that experience because, you know, truth is truth. There's just, this isn't stuff that I made up. This just has really nothing to do with me in a way. So when you hear it or feel it, and you go, wow, which is why it's so wonderful, and I mean this, that we sent out that email yesterday, and many of you were here because of the email, and I thought, oh, great, they've heard me speak before. You know, that just changes everything about how the class can go. I mean, any sense of needing to be careful just dissipates. But the hard part, there's several things about what you just said that I'd like to comment on. One is, I mean, still to this day, choosing an expansive understanding of life, choosing to look outside of the proverbial box that so many people live in, it can be a little lonely. This is why spiritual community is so important. And it's not just like Ananda is the only spiritual community. It's not. But walking the spiritual path in truth and making great spiritual progress is not anything that anybody can do alone. I mean, first of all, we need a teacher. We all need a teacher. And we need to be open to the idea of God's grace. Yogananda says making progress on the spiritual path is 25% the guru's help, 25% our effort, and 50% God's grace. For those of you who don't know, when I mention Yogananda, Yogananda is a man who was born in the very late 1800s. He came over here in his early 20s in 1922. And he was an avatar. And an avatar means those people who come onto this earth because we need them. We call to them in need. The earth needs a pure being of light. This is what happened when Christ came. The Jewish people were in a lot of trouble. And they called. This is what happened when Krishna came or Buddha. And this is the same about Yogananda. There are many saints in the world today. Many, many great people from whom we could learn enormous amounts and grow spiritually. But the avatars are rare. And when they come, what they say is only and always truth. We may not understand it yet. And in our misunderstanding, we may not want to accept it. But what they say, so when I say, he said, 25% the help of the guru, 25% our effort, 50% God's grace. It's just simply the truth, whether we can know what that means or not. It's the truth. That's why I said going to that conference for me was pure grace. I didn't know anything. I didn't know why I was going to hear somebody talk about a mandala society. I mean, I could just go on and on. It's just, I just feel like sometimes, and this happens so often to all of us if we're open to it, that God has a way through these great saints, through teachers, through each other. God is purely manifesting through all of us. We may not know it. But God speaks to us in a lot of ways. So when I sat in that room and prayed the other night, give me an answer, and I've learned after 67 years in the world this time, I often say to God, I don't want any of your riddles. Your riddles are too hard. Just tell me straight. And then Yijen walks up and just tells me the answer. That God used her and came to me through her. You know? And then Jesus said, for those who have ears to hear, I was listening. It brought tears to my eyes when she said what she said to me. She was saying something very nice to me. But I did not take it personally. I wasn't crying because I thought I was great. I was crying because I prayed and God listened. It was so powerful for me. So God can really come to us in a lot of ways, but this pull back to what you're calling convention, it's very real. That is the struggle on the spiritual path. That is the work that we're doing, the energy that we're putting out, that we have to put out. We will make no progress without it. All of my friends really want me to go out for a drink tonight, but there's a great play at Ananda at 7 o'clock tonight. Where am I going to be? There's going to be 5 people up here acting as Yogananda's disciples, speaking truth to us for 2 hours. by, everybody saying, oh, come on, Shanti, come on out with us. I know for years I rarely travel with anybody anymore. I spend less and less and less on people who are not fully committed to the spiritual path, but I have a lot of friends who are not on the path the way I am, or where I am, or whatever. And I used to do a lot of traveling, a lot of adventure traveling. And every morning these people would wake up and say, oh, because they want to get going. Do you have to meditate this morning? Meditation was something you could just skip because you were on a camping trip or something. And it would be very easy to say, oh no, let's just get going. We're going into the mountains, it's gorgeous, I'm going to be hiking, I'll be out in nature. The mind does those things to us. It's very easy to do what we already know and to be, I'm sure most people in this room are good people, so we're doing good things. It's not like we're bad. Probably there's not a murderer in the room, or I imagine most of you have not, or you're not now out there stealing things. You know, we're good people, but that's very different than making great spiritual effort. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't add up necessarily, and there's a lot of stories I could tell, but it would really take me so far away from the subject that I don't know if I can find my way back. But a lot of stories in the Ramayana and all these spiritual teachings about people who looked one way in the world but who were great saints, and people who were trying to look like great saints in the world but who weren't making any progress. The spiritual path is, it's tricky and it takes effort. But I will tell everybody this, the most important thing that you could do, and believe me, this all ties in, because this is wisdom, which is one of the eight attributes, which transcends all rational thought and mind. It's living. Wisdom, the pure experience of wisdom, is beyond mind. Living in a place of pure intuition, pure knowing. That, and that's what some of these things are. If you really are serious about being on the spiritual path, you have to spend time, and you'll do more and more of your time with other people who are also committed to seeking on the spiritual path. Because there's too many friends of ours, too many family members, too many people. They're not bad people. They just want us to be with them because they love us in the best of circumstances. Sometimes they want us to be with them so they can torture us, but they don't call it that. But for whatever reason, you know, they will keep drawing us back. And it's easy for us to be drawn back into it. It's very easy. So we have to be really rigorous, energetic, astute, make decisions and stay with them. Not that we're not having fun doing it. I remember not that many years ago, a couple in our congregation got married, and some of the family members, Asha and I were standing around, one of the family members came up and said to us, God, you people have so, this was at a big wedding, so their daughters and sons got married here, down in our community. You people have so much fun. And you don't even drink. There's no alcohol in it either. I mean, they just couldn't believe that people could have that much fun without help. You know. So, I mean, joy is another one of the attributes, and finding that joy. No, we have great fun, but it's different. It really is different. And here's another thing that I've found. I learned this lesson with my first husband, who was a mess. He was just the messiest thing in the world. And I've already told you, some of you earlier, I'm a Virgo and I'm not a mess. And I realized probably a year into my marriage that it was hopeless because he didn't see it as a mess and he didn't care that it was a mess. So I either had to be willing to sustain it here, or if we were going to find a lowest common denominator, it was going to be a mess. And that is as true for how we live our lives. It's very easy to find ourselves having spent a whole evening of our lives watching, at best, some meaningless television shows, at worst, some really horrible television shows, sitting around doing chitter-chatter, gossip, night after night. But it's what many of us do all the time. It's what a lot of my friends who are really good people, but I can leave them after a 3 or 4 hour evening and think, oh my God, we didn't say one meaningful word. And we have to ask ourselves, how much time do we want to spend there? And I'm not saying that I know the answer for everybody, because it depends on where we are on our path. What is our next step? If you try and take somebody else's next step, it doesn't even matter if it's a good step for them. Spiritually, you feel so out of tune and out of step with your own life, and you are. So this isn't a matter of judgment. This is a matter of saying, if you want to be growing spiritually, make some decisions about what the next step would look like, and then stick to it. Because just like when you ski, it's really easy to get into somebody else's ruts. It just is. It's the nature of life. So, yeah.
So, you know, you obviously spend a lot of time speaking and teaching people and basically helping people along their spiritual path. You know, but, like, I guess, how do you balance being able to relate to people who are not as far along, right? Or all these friends who are not on that path that you're like, oh, I think this person's life would be a lot better if they were on that path. How do you balance wanting to be close enough to that to reach out to it versus being in this pure path where you yourself can excel?
Well, that's a very important question. The first year that I lived in community, and went on to community, the first couple of years, I spent a lot of time crying, literally, because so many of my very best friends, you know, there are people who have been in my life since I'm 5 years old. I mean, she's a sister. She's not, got easier when I realized she was a sister and not a friend, because then I could behave with her the way we might with sisters. But, you know, I just, as Asha said to me one day, you have a lot of people karma, and I do. I sort of attract people, and they tend to stay, which is why I've never, ever even gone to the Facebook site. I feel like, oh my God, they'll all find a reason. But, you know, I say it really like this. So I started realizing that I was not going to want to have as much to do with those people. It was like trying to speak in two different languages, and it was very painful. Now, I had been on a spiritual path for a while, and moving into the community it just meant that I was changing the entire foreground and background of my life. So that's an extreme version of it. But it does start getting in your way, so I want to be honest about that. But the other answer to the question that is so important is that we are not responsible for anybody else's karma or their life, nor can we necessarily have a huge impact on it. You know, it's like when I moved up to Woodside, up on Skyline Drive at one point, we bought a house in the woods. There were some feral cats up there that came to our house all the time. And my husband wanted to feed them, and he wanted them to let him touch them and hold them. And they just wouldn't. And he just got so angry at them that he had to get them in a have-a-heart thing one day, which was not easy, and drive them 10 miles down Skyline and let them out, because they wouldn't let him love them the way he wanted to love them. They were feral cats. They needed to have the food put out and be left alone. And it sounds like a silly story, but it's not. So I have come to realize that I will have the biggest impact, because I'm a teacher, and I do feel one of the big purposes of my life right now is to share some of what I've learned. And we all do anyway. We all want to share that which we found that is so wonderful. But I have found that living the teachings is the best thing I can do. Really getting myself to live them more and more, refining my spiritual presence has a huge... I do it because it's good for me. I don't want to have another 10,000 lifetimes if I can help it. Life is hard. I've had a great life. You can hear I've been very successful. I love practicing medicine. Here I am at Ananda. I've been blessed with so much love in my life. But life isn't all that easy. Filled with disappointments and worries and this and that. And, you know, I'd love to be free. I know what that feels like. I have many years ago. But, so I'm doing it for myself. But there's a magnetism to it. It's energy. Energy is magnetic. Energy has a positive pole and a negative pole. And people start coming around and saying, what is it? what is it about you? Now, you have to be careful, because boy, can that work its way into your ego. But it's not about me. If you ever had to spend time with Shanti, the personality Shanti, well, you know, very quickly you'd be arguing with me the way you do with most people in your life. I could be a big pain in the rear end. I'm very strong. I know how I want things to be. They're hard. It would be hard to live with it, honestly. But the less time I spend in my personality, the more you can feel the way somebody can be a channel for what is beyond that personality. People are drawn to it. I've had a profound experience. I've had so many of them, but I was at Kaiser one day where I do some urgent care. I just do a half a day a week now. But it's just how I keep medicine in my mind, so I don't lose it at this point. But this is a couple of years ago. There was a woman who came in. I wouldn't have remembered this story, but again, it was in this talk that I was just listening to. And she had caught her toenail on something, and it had pulled away from her toe, and, you know, it was a bother to her. It was horrible. I won't describe it, because even I could pass out. Never mind my word here. But she came in to see me in urgent, it's an urgent care clinic, but I'm a medical doctor, and I went into medicine for a reason. She thought I was going to take her toenail off. Well, I mean, the idea of it almost had me feeling cold and clammy. You know, I was going to do this. But I also didn't think she should have the toenail taken off, because I'm a big hiker, and I've had a lot of injuries to my toes. And I developed this technique of finding this completely see-through tape. They sell it in all the drugstores, but it's completely see-through adhesive. It's an unusual. And I cut it in these tiny little thin strips, and you can keep wrapping it around the base of the toenail. You have to change it at least once a day, sometimes more. It holds the toenail in place till the new nail comes in. So I was just talking to her, and we were together like that. I mean, she came in thinking she was having surgery. I gave her a roll of tape, you know, made on crutch. And then she said to me, you know, I want to ask you a question. And she asked me this question. She said, I've had a very dear friend. This woman's been my friend all my life. And she had a very bad accident a number of years ago, and she's been in chronic pain, and she's needed a lot of surgeries. And she said, she's so negative. She is so difficult. And she said, and tomorrow I have to take her over for another same-day surgery. And she said, this woman is already yelling at me about how I'm not doing it right. She doesn't like that I'm going to drop her off and come back. She doesn't think I'm giving her enough. She's telling this whole story. And the woman said, do you have any suggestions for me about how I could be with her tomorrow that would be better for me and for her than my being angry? Now, the reason I'm telling you the story, of course I had suggestions. That's what I do in my life, I have suggestions. But I had good suggestions for her. And when she went to leave, I said, I know you came to have surgery and you got a roll of tape, but I really think that this is why you came. And she said, oh, it's absolutely why I came here today. She knew. But what made her even know that she should ask me that question? If she asked any, she wouldn't have asked. Had any of you ever been to an urgent care clinic, at Kaiser or otherwise? You wouldn't ask those doctors you're seeing, could you help me solve this biggest riddle of my life? You know? That's not what they're there to do. It's not what most of them know how to do. But she was having an experience that was beyond that toe, and she knew it, very much to her credit, because energy's magnetic, and she felt it. And I have had hundreds, if not thousands, of beautiful experiences in medicine because people feel who you are, and they know. So what we can do for everybody is we just start practicing it and trying to teach people anything, even us. If people do it to me, I've just gotten smart enough to learn to say to some of the people, that's not helpful for me right now. I can feel that's not where I am. I'm not going to learn the lesson. You can raise your voice at me. You can say it, you know, the way you do when you argue with your partner or somebody. You're so sure that your argument's sane and valid. Wait a minute, I'm just going to try and say it a different way. Now I'll say it a little different way. Certainly you'll see that I'm right. That's what's inherent in that. But rarely does that happen because people have to learn their own lessons, and they will move at their pace. And that's simply painful sometimes. And this is where you can get into an experience of actually needing to leave relationships or separate from people that meant a great deal to you at one time, and there was a reason for them to be there at one time. But whoever said it had to be forever? We don't know. So I think when there's enough love there and we are spiritually mature enough and emotionally mature enough, we learn to just be who we are, not need them to be like us, and not react to their need to have us be like them, which is hard. It's very hard. And it shows a great deal of maturity. But it's the loving thing to do. It's the love, is to really see the divine in everyone and know for certain that they are perfect as they are. They are. And then they will see the light when it's time. But there is that saying from the Bible, the light shineth and the darkness comprehended it not. And it's powerful, but it's real. So we may feel how much good what we're doing is doing for us, but it doesn't mean it's good for everybody that we love. So, and in fact, Swami says somewhere that if we try too hard to teach somebody something they're not ready for, we can cost them a lot of lifetimes. Because, you know, I watch myself do it with my husband more often than I'd like to admit, though way less often than I was doing it a year ago or 5 years ago or 10. Then he has to get stronger to resist me. He has to get more firmly set in his ways, because they're his ways.
I was just realizing what a good friend I have who lives in Vallejo. And when I lived there 2.5 years ago, we were talking all the time. And then I moved here, and we were talking for like an hour every week. And now we're down to 30 minutes every 3 weeks. And it's, she tells me things, I tell her things, and she's just letting me go, and I'm letting her go. It's just kind of and I just realized, you know, we're just accepting each other, but we have very little in common anymore. And that's just what it is.
That's a nice version of it. I mean, it really is. It's a nice version of it. And it does happen that way sometimes. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you this, and I love that.
Yeah,
but
I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, you spoke more than that. That's that, and obviously happens. It's happening.
We haven't talked about it that way.
Right.
You know, but we just.
And you might not be able to talk about it, but it's just happening. But I have a lot of people in my life who are furious with me. I really do. That one of the people who I've been best friends with the longest, she tells my other friends, like, I won't hear. I don't know what she's thinking, but Shanti just expects me to do so much, and she thinks I ought to do this, and she, and I don't. Herself, whatever she's feeling about not, but she's hurt and angry just because I'm living my life doesn't as much include her. So it's a challenge, but I don't want to sound too sad, because that's a nice version, and sometimes it just works. You know, sometimes people are like, thank God you're doing this because it helped me see, or, you know, I've taken my next steps, and it can really work well. But it's challenging. It's like watching people, you know, where there's an alcoholic or a drug addict in the family, and everybody thinks if the alcoholic gets clean and sober, the drug addict quits using, everything's going to be fine in the family. But very often when that person quits using, the whole family falls apart for a number of reasons. The person gets into recovery, they start expanding. Well, nobody wanted them to expand very much. They were pretty used to having them be sick, you know. So, I mean, it's complicated when one person changes. It's very complicated, not just within a couple, but within a family, within a friendship. Everybody has to reckon with where they are. What we can do, those of us who are trying to do it consciously, is do it consciously. It's just stay conscious, not expect anything else of these other people. See what's whole and rich in them and honor that. Because the truth is, there is nothing in this universe. Nothing. This comes up all the time. People come to see me as a doctor in my private practice. Why do they come? Because they think I hate medicine and I'm going to be the doctor who's going to tell them, oh no, you don't need an antibiotic for your pneumonia or your urinary tract infection, or no, you don't need to have your appendix out when you're having recurrent bouts of appendicitis. No, that is not what I do. But I do say to them, you think that God is any more in a flower essence than he is in penicillin? Why, that would be absurd. Nothing can exist in the universe that doesn't come originally. And I say this in different words, depending on who's sitting in my office. So to really know that no matter who you look at, and this is almost the end of the talk, but we'll get here now before the break, because this is very important. This is what, well, it's essential to experience God in any of these ways. But when we would get to wisdom, you know, which is really hard to talk about, you know, it's like trying to talk about the seventh chakra. It's impossible. There's so little about the earth about it that you just can't. But one of the ways to have an experience of wisdom is to see God in everyone and everything, and to have that be a practice. And if you try it, you'll see how often we're challenged by it. But again, there's a couple of people who have heard me tell this, just hear it again. You're here for a reason. But about 12, I keep saying 12 years ago, now it's probably 15 years ago, I had a profound experience with my husband. And I was actually considering leaving him, and I wrote him a long letter telling him why I had to leave him. And it was such a brilliant letter, and it was so obviously the truth, and how could I be with somebody who wasn't as committed to spiritual path as I was? And as we were, he was telling me how that just couldn't be the case, and it was absurd that I was thinking of leaving him. It came to me, again, as an intuition. There's no words for these experiences, but you just have to hear. God spoke to me. It said, you know, you're not leaving him. He's yours. And you don't stay where things aren't right, so how are you going to make this right? And the next intuition, I'm saying it in words so you think I was analyzing or thinking, but I wasn't. It came to me. I was told this. You will never see anything wrong with him again. You will never look at him and see he's wrong in this way, he's wrong in that way, if only this, if only that. When you look at him, you will only see God looking back out through those eyes of him. It was profound. I did an immediate, talk about stopping on a dime and turning 180 degrees in the midst of the phone call, because he was elsewhere, we were doing this on the phone. And I never said a word to him. I never told him, I mean for years, about that experience. But I will tell you, I knew it to be the truth. I knew that karmically I would be with him as long as we were both on this, in these bodies, which we both still are. And within 3 days, he was a different man. Why was he a different man? Not because he was changed. It wasn't really about him. It let me see how powerful it could be for the other person to see them as the divine. Because it's the truth. Most people on this earth have never had the experience of being seen so well. People don't really listen to us. They don't really see us for who we are. Most people are constantly trying to make us to be more like them or how they want us to be. You tell somebody an experience you're having, 99 point something percent of the time, they'll say, I know just what you mean. You know how this is. And then they talk about themselves. Very few people listen. Feel guilty when I say this out loud because you start noticing it and it makes you crazy. Very few people say, really, you're having that experience? Tell me more. Or what happened after that? We're rarely heard or seen. It touches your heart. That's the experience that woman was having in Kaiser that day. You know? There was a woman who came to my talk at East West once. She stood up at the top. This room was packed. And she said, this woman was my doctor when I was in the hospital. She had been in a psychiatric hospital in Belmont. It doesn't even exist over and over. And she said she came into that hospital and she just saw me as a regular human being. That's what this lady said. She said it was instantly healing. I didn't do anything. I just was there. I listened to her. So simple. So simple how healing occurs. And what we all need. We don't get it very often. So when you can just look at somebody, and it's the truth, I'm not anywhere near 100% with my husband, but I'm 1,000% better than I was. 1,000. You know, and very often, just when things are going to get the hardest, Shanti, would you fight with God about this? No, right now. Just breathe. You don't have to prove anything. I mean, it just comes to me. God's here. He's talking to you. Listen. And it's amazing how much we argue about, fight about, get upset about, you know, struggle about even within ourselves. It's meaningless. I often now say to people, you know what? You're not even going to remember this experience in 6 days or 6 weeks or 6 months. Can you let it go now? It'll be nothing soon. Why struggle with it now? Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But it's the truth anyway. You know, it's really interesting. When I wanted to talk, this is unfolding differently than I thought, but it's totally fine. But I would like to talk a little bit about love. We'll take a break and when we come back. And I wanted to play two songs, and I'm going to do it for you. One is a song by a man whose name is Michael Ball, who is, he's in England like with the equivalent of the biggest Broadway stars would be here. You know, England does a lot of theater. In London there's as much as there is in New York City. And he's like it there. And he did a play there many, many years ago called The Aspects of Love. And there's a song from there called Love Changes Everything. And for, do you know the song? And for many years, well, I'm going to play it for you. And for many years, I would just play this song for inspiration. You know, I just love, and I still have to admit, I love the song. But then I'm going to play for us Swami's song called Love is a Magician. Swami Kriyananda. Swami Kriyananda wrote over 450 pieces of music, which is pretty amazing. But they're inspired. He just heard them. And I think we'll be able to feel something that I've been trying to say, even about how we love other people well when you hear these songs. Because I can love Love Changes Everything, but even when I listen to it today, I realize, well, I don't want to give it away. I want to see how you see. So how about if we just take a little break, and those restrooms in the yoga studio are, there's a yoga class that's going on. So if you need to use the restroom or get a cup of tea or some water, you have to go to the teaching center where you registered. The music for you, I'm going to talk a little bit about sound and then just a little bit more about love. Does anybody, before I move on, any comments or questions? You can see how welcome they are because really, although it's out of order, I wind up being able to cover everything that I thought we should talk about, so feel free. Okay, good. So I first wanted to talk about, and now I'm going to go into the attributes a little bit, and remember what we're talking about is the ways that divine energy manifests when in its purest energetic form. If we can get in tune with that, we are knowing, having an experience of the divine. So that's what that means. So sound, which we all know sound, it's the easiest to think of sound in a way because we all always think of sound as vibration. We know that. We can feel it. We understand what makes different sounds and that it has to do with vibration and frequency, which is what we're talking about everything, but it's a little harder when you're talking about calmness or peace to imagine it that way. Sound is pure vibration, and it is, in its purest form, the sound of that superconsciousness that I was describing before, which is what we call Om, or what in other languages they call Amen or Amin. It's all that sound of the divine, which is why we chant Om so much. And in fact, I forgot that I did want to bring the Om CD over, but I'm not going to go back and do it now. Unless we have time at the very end, we can sit and listen to it for a few minutes. We'll see how it goes. But it's that sound that incorporates every other sound in the universe. Again, these things are hard to imagine logically, and when you hear them, when I'm trying to meditate, and there's horns honking, or sirens going, or whatever else is going on, very consciously, I'll say to myself, bring it into Om, and I can just mentally start chanting Om in my mind and try and bring that sound into it, because at a different frequency of vibration, it is that. So there's nothing that we can't transform into that, and we just need to use it that way. So instead of finding it distracting, then I can say to myself, bring it in and let it be. Now I'm going to play some music for you in a bit, and we'll have that experience of where sound can take us. But before I do that, I just wanted to talk a little bit about love in ways that I didn't get to speak about before, because the two pieces I'm going to play for you are all about love. So we all think we know what love is. We've all probably felt what we consider to be love. We're not talking in this class about human love. We're not even talking about, I think the most unconditional love people can feel in the world is with their animals, really much of the time, or with their brand new babies. It doesn't take long for the love for those babies to become conditional. You know, it's really the truth. New parents hate to hear this, but it is absolutely the truth, as much as you don't want to admit it. The kids start acting out very early, and you both start having your own ideas about how their life is supposed to be, and conditions come in. And it happens sooner than most people think. But there's still, I mean, the love of a two-year-old or a three-year-old, or by the time they're people, like, I mean, you know, on yours, by the time they're 10 or 11 or 12 and really able to act out, other things come to your conscious mind. But, you know, even though you can get upset with the toddler, and many parents do get very upset, particularly toddlers who are hyperactive or who don't sleep well. I mean, it's amazing what people come in and say, how some of the fantasies they have about how they would like to quiet their children or things. These are perfectly loving parents. But a brand new baby, people feel, it just opens people's hearts. And again, I've had that experience. I don't know if you have. There are two women in my life right now who are both tough women. One was the daughter of a friend, and, well, they're both daughters of friends. Let me just leave it there so I not give away too much of my thought here. These talks go up on the web, by the way, so people all over the world listen to them, and then you get responses to it. So you have to be careful or mindful. I would say mindful. But both of these women were just tough, really had their hearts shut down, and, you know, were cool and careful in the world. And each of them, as soon as they had their first child, just went through enormous transformation. It just opens your heart. For a lot of women, particularly, to have a child and then to be faced with what it means to nurture and to care for that being. So, and of course, it's understandable. There's a reason that child actually chose that body to come through. I mean, this is not happenstance here. You know, we choose the families we'll come into. Karmically, it's going to work for us. So there's already a connection. Sometimes the connections are not easy. But that doesn't mean that they're not right for us in terms of being able to move on spiritually and work through things. I had a really challenging relationship with my older sister. She was about 2.5 years older than I was. She was pretty crazy. She was an angry, not psychotically crazy, but very difficult woman. But somehow I became her. I just took care of her, I mean, in many ways. But that relationship. And still, she died when she was 42, so it's been a long time that she hasn't been around. But I feel her, and it's been one of the most meaningful and wonderful and life-expanding, soul-expanding relationships that I've ever had. And it was never easy. There was not a minute of it that was easy. In fact, I was frequently trying to figure out how not to be near her. But I was always called back there. So we just never know. If we start looking at everything in life as being perfect and exactly what we need to take our next steps, we let go of a lot of the judgment of the good or the bad. But part of the reason that we have all these relationships in life, mother, father, friends, partners, children, is really to begin to learn how to love. I mean, in a way, it just teaches us. You just heard me tell a story about my husband and I. Again, not necessarily an easy relationship for a lot of years, but perfect, exactly perfect. I know that we belong together. And I say many times he's been one of my biggest teachers in this life, in the best sense. So if we start looking at relationships like that, consciously looking at relationships like that, then we see that. And remember, I said, so I just wanted to bring it up again, my commitment was to see God in him. And then one day I said to myself, you know, it's not just you should be doing this with Barry. You should be doing this with everybody. And, you know, it's a practice. So we practice things until we become perfect. And I am far from there. But it's a practice as much as possible. Even I know when people come into my office, and I don't know how many of you work with the public, but when people just come in, you know, everybody's not just naturally wonderful. It can be a little bit of a challenge at times. But I always say to myself, why is this person here? I always say that. But with the real, why is this person here? Why did they come to see me right now? And when you do it that way, it opens up a world of possibility that I might not have had when I was sitting there thinking, oh, my station is so neurotic, and other things that I have been known to think and say about people in the past. And it's in every field. I mean, I'm sure you do feel it with students and maybe even more with parents. You know, it can be challenging whatever we do in the world. I don't know what everybody does. But the beginning of that realization that everything that's in our life is there for a reason and that we can learn about opening our hearts, feeling compassion, and loving through it is really a huge step on the spiritual path. Because in its purest form, in the divine love form, remember, and that's what we're looking for. We are looking to get out of the emotional, contracted, possessive, jealous, I could use all these words, levels of relationship, all of which, a lot of which reside, we feel it from the heart. But if we move from emotion in this heart to devotion, you have a very different experience. And just like I told you, within 3 days, Barry would change dramatically. People change in our lives when we begin to see what is whole and best and rich in them, and to see them as manifestations of divine energy. I know I said it, but I want to say it in this context. And it is so good for us. You will see what a different feeling you have in this area of your body. I mean, even if we learn to sit the way we teach people to sit in beginning meditation, so you sit with your spine straight, and I always say to people, just try it for a minute. Rotate your shoulders, and stop when your shoulders are back, like this, and relax them down. And if you do that, and you just hold your arms like that, look at what happens to your heart. If you're sitting up straight, that heart just opens, and very different things happen in your life, in your relation to people. Yesterday I was sitting with a woman in my office, a patient, and she was telling me, interestingly, but it's just true, about a dear friend she's had all of her life, similar to the last story I just told you about Kaiser, but different, who this other woman happens to have bipolar disease and is being very pressured and difficult in her life. And she was saying to me, how can I deal with her? How can I, what should I say to her? And as we were sitting in my office and she was talking, you know, she was sitting there like this, literally, the whole time I was talking. And I was even saying things like, you know, the more that you would open your heart to her, and I was sitting in, now for most people, if you do that, they automatically sit up and over. No, she stayed just like this. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about her when we go to talk about power, because that her biggest lesson was not even about her heart. Though the lesson I gave her yesterday was both about power, which is another manifestation of divine energy, which I'll come back to, and the third chakra, and then the heart in the fourth. So, and you know, we're trying to open and expand each of these energetic centers in our being. All of the attributes of the divine or manifestations of the divine do not relate so beautifully to the chakras. But it just so happens that power really does rest in the third chakra, so I'll talk about it a little bit. And of course, love has to do with the heart. But I thought, you know, you cannot love somebody that way. You can't. you have to, that speaks about where her energy is. You know, so even the way that we hold ourselves will make a difference, not just in how others perceive us, but in what we have to give. If we lead in the world with our heart, we don't have to even think about the feeling behind it. I could tell you for sure, if you start practicing, walking more like this and sitting more like this, heart open, your whole life will change. And that's, I'm saying that consciously and thoughtfully. It is not hyperbole. You change your posture, you change the way you take steps, you begin to move in a way that draws your energy in, that allows it to come in and up, instead of being out in the world, tripping over things, breaking things. It's very different. So if you can't figure out how to change the way you think about it or whatever, just start changing your physical being. Everything follows. It's very powerful. If you practice it, you see. If you're having trouble relating to somebody at work or wherever, see what happens if you sit up straighter. See what happens if you start asking yourself to smile a little bit, or if you consciously think about smiling with your eyes, about letting a little joy come through your eyes. Not, you don't want to look ridiculous, you want to look like a clown in the office, but, you know, in subtle ways. Because we're talking about soul qualities. We mostly live in the world in terms of egoic qualities. Whether we don't often think about it like that, of course, why would we? But we're mostly drawn in the world, moved around in the world, react in the world, create in the world based on ego. And ego is really, has us separate from our true reality. Now we're talking about soul qualities that are going to lead us back to that oneness with the superconsciousness, which you can think of as all souls rolled into one big ball, because that's really what it is in a way. So if we start thinking about soul qualities and relating in the world that way, people react differently. It's very interesting. Swami Kriyananda tells a lot of stories of things that have happened to him in the world, like sitting down and having a dinner when he didn't really have a lot of money in Carmel, and the waiter coming over and saying, you know, or the owner of the restaurant, I just don't want to charge you for this meal. And I don't know, I've asked this in many classes, and maybe people are just shy. Has anybody had an extraordinary experience like that, where somebody just opens up and gives you something in the world unexpectedly? Is it a story you care to share?
Sure. I was traveling with two other girlfriends, and we were in Queensland, New Zealand, and we were at a little Thai restaurant, and we were literally counting our change to make sure we had enough money before we ordered the dessert to make sure we paid the bill. And two women sitting across the restaurant noticed, and the waiter comes over with desserts on a platter, puts it down, and like, oh, we didn't order those. You know, we're not quite sure if we can do that. And he's like, no, it's from the table over there. And so we went over and we said thank you to the ladies, and they said that they had saw us counting our coins, that they traveled when they were younger, and that they wanted to buy us dessert because they remember being in that place. And then they ended up asking us more questions. We were living out of like a camper van and showering at the YMCA. And they invited us to their hotel the next day to take warm showers. And then they gave us like tea and coffee. Uh-huh. And
very
yeah, and so we ended up going to their hotel the next day.
Very,
it was great.
Yeah, that's a very sweet story. Really sweet. Yeah, I had an experience just a couple of years ago where there was somebody who was in front of me in Trader Joe's, and she went to pay for her groceries, and you could see it was legit. She goes, oh my God, I left my wallet at home. You know, you could just see, she was like, it was dinner time. And I said to her, how much are your groceries? And she told me, and I said, you know what? Just let this be on me. You know, and it was, I mean, it was just mostly, I was probably in a hurry and I was trying to, but it was, but you know, it was like just that kind of act of generosity. And I know I didn't do it for any reason. It was totally spontaneous that her life was changed, just like yours was. But I think also people feel our energy. And I will tell you for sure, because I have had many experiences where I've walked in and somebody in the hotel says, you know what, I'm going to put you in the suite. Or three or four times where I've just been moved up to first class on a plane. It doesn't happen that much anymore because there's no more first class. There's so many things like this. There are so many, you know, all first class is booked almost all the time now, you know, when you fly, but it's different. But so many times, well, what is that? People just feel. So you start paying attention to how you move, and particularly with your heart. And I'm just wondering. So what we're talking about is love, not looking at another human being and getting very up close and personal with them. We're talking about the soul quality of love, which we can feel just inside, open our hearts, let our face be relaxed, and people will feel it. So I just mentioned sound and love, and I want to do this just to have a feeling. Play a lot today, but just these two songs that I was thinking about this morning. So the first is that song that I was telling you about that Michael Ball sings from Aspects of Love, called Love Changes Everything. I fast-forwarded through the beginning, but he's giving a concert. It's the last song, and they start playing the overture to it, and you just hear these wild screams from this, you know, probably 10,000 people, literally. And when they all get all done screaming, he said, did you think I wasn't going to sing it? Everybody loves this song. But what I'd like you to do, sound and love, I'd like you to close your eyes and listen to the song and think about where you're feeling the energy when you feel this. Because remember, sound is around us all the time. How unconsciously do we listen to music, right? And not think about the impact that it's having on us. So I'm not going to play it all. I'll stop it somewhere, but no bigger truth than love does change everything, he said. It's going to get louder. It gets louder. Glory. stay where you are now. Just stay where you are. I find this next song. Interested to hear if anybody's interested to speak about the different experiences you had when we think about sound and where it can take us. Two songs about love. Did anybody feel a different singing? There's no wrong answer. Both of them were?
Yes, and both of them, they kind of blended together for me. Mm-hmm. I think probably the last half. And so it was just exceedingly relaxing and integrating.
Okay. Very good. Anybody else?
Thank you.
anybody else have an experience?
Well, I thought it was interesting. The second song, there was definitely sadness. You know what I mean? I feel like it painted the concept of love by showing the opposite of being like the strip and like, you know, in these other situations until we found it. And so I thought that was an interesting way to portray it because the song to me read sad in many ways.
Did it feel sad or did the words are one thing? Can you describe the feeling that you had?
No, it didn't feel sad, but I think my overall feeling was not sad, but like the, I don't know, it was a minor key, but like something about the music composition, you know, was definitely, it was more overtly uplifting. Mm-hmm. It was uplifting and kind of, it sinks you. And then upwards you from there.
Yeah. I think, you know, I'm not going to take a lot of time with it, but if we listened again, we could hear the first song, which I happen to love, which is how I prefaced it to you earlier. You weren't here, Atmajyoti, but it's a song from what would be a Broadway play. I don't know what it's called in London, but it's by a very famous artist. And he sings beautifully. And the song just grabs you, and it's so, like, love changes everything, and you're marching out, and I used to listen to it constantly before talks or anything. But to me, that, and I'll share with you, the song is a very emotional song. It's very much about human love. It's what it's meant to be about. You fall in love, your whole world changes. And it's true. I once had a friend say to me, he had been single, he was probably 55 when he said to me, "That's it, I'm getting online, I am finding a woman." He said, because when you fall in love, your whole world changes from black and white to color. And, you know, I could really know what he was talking about. And I think that's the song, that song from Aspects, that's the feeling that it brings. If we could play it again, or if you want to ever just Google it at home and you'll find it, Love Changes Everything. It gets you into your heart, and it's emotional, and it keeps you in your heart. It's a good feeling. It's a wonderful feeling. He's saying, even when he said, you know, brings you glory, brings you shame, nothing in the world will ever be the same, and it just feels right. Although Swamiji's words are, "How long I did stray, flung lifetimes away," you know, he just talks, but of course he's singing to God, and he's saying now, "Love is all I know, sun rays on a glow," and he talks about, "I'm just coming to realize." The words are sad, and interestingly, there's a bit of it in a minor key, but no, very few people feel sad when they listen. They feel peaceful, they feel calm. In a way, if you could pay attention to energy, the energy comes higher than the heart. Even though you're right, and it's hard, I think, the first time. Many of us in this room have heard that song many times, but when you listen to the words, which you would, because I know those words, and just now I was listening, I was saying, wow, these are strangers, maybe I should have played an instrumental, because your mind just wants to hear what the words are saying. But even you were saying, no, I didn't really feel sad, and yet the words were sad, the word for that is the music, I just said it, but it's not dissonant, but it's a minor chord. And so certain music, and now the music, like I used to love to dance, I was a big dancer, I used to win dance contests on television, but you know, you start realizing that music gets you by your lower chakras and it just doesn't let go. I mean, it just holds you there to really pay attention to sound in your life and what it does for you and where it leaves you. And even with that, I'm not going to try to prove anything, but I intentionally played Swami's music last, second, because I'd rather leave people with that thing. Yes?
Yeah, I heard the first song, it didn't move me particularly. Huh. The second one, I didn't really even listen to the words, but I just felt like I had this big ball of white light. Mm-hmm. And this peacefulness, I didn't want it to be over. It was so awesome.
Yeah, it's a beautiful song. Yeah, I'm glad you had. I think that's the energy of it. And if I played it again, let's see where we go. But maybe we'll end the class with that. And you don't listen to the song, but you feel the words. Swami said it's the hardest song he's ever written for people to sing, in part because the words are saying something that could take the human mind somewhere. But the energy is really about the love of God. It's a profound song. Ananda is built very much around music. There's a huge amount of music at Ananda. There are very few people who have the courage to sing that song. I mean, of the real musicians. So it's interesting. But it's, the feeling can be extraordinary if we helped you away from the words. And very often when I teach meditation, I say to people, go down to East West, speak to Lee, who's in charge of all the music, and tell him that Shanti sent you for inspired music. Because, you know, music that's inspired comes from a different place. It speaks to our soul. And eventually, and particularly the instrumental music, will just get us out of our head. Whereas most of the music that's written speaks to some other human quality. Whether it's trying to turn us on, I mean, I think certain aspects of rap were really meant to deliver political, social messages. Of course, so did the folk music of the 60s, yet those didn't leave us feeling angry as much as, I think, inspired in a certain way to make change. I mean, folk music was profound in terms of its effect. But nonetheless, to get conscious about what we're listening to. Or yesterday I noticed I was driving, I told you before, I listened to the new KCBS, and they kept coming back to this story of the, demonstration in San Francisco, where the people were pounding the spoons. Did anybody else hear it or know that? Okay. Well, they decided to demonstrate yesterday by hitting spoons on metal bars near the BART stations, if not on the BART themselves. And it was a cacophony of sounds. It was, every time it came on, I had to just absolutely immediately turn it off. Because, or you know, you hear a song in the morning. So other than Swami's music, I do not play music at my house in the morning. Somebody plays a song or hums a song, and it's with you all day. It's because it's energy, and it has magnetized your energy. So just being mindful of this matters. Okay. Any more comments or questions? I want to talk a little bit about power, and then I'm going to talk about a little bit about joy. And we'll see where we go with those two things. The reason I want to talk about power is because it's the hardest way for people to think of God. And people particularly who consciously get on a spiritual path often think that they're supposed to be really lovely and sweet and quiet and inward and just like this, until soon you can't find them. We are not talking about egotistical power. We're talking about opening up and having an experience of divine power. I mean, look at all of what Jesus did, or I didn't get to meet Yogananda, of course, though I always loved that I was already born and he was still here. No, I love that I was on this earth when he was. But they said he used to come running out on stage. You know, literally, I mean, he would pack Carnegie Hall. This was in the 1920s, can you imagine? That people went to see this Swami coming out with, he had really long hair, looking, and people ask him all the time, are you a man or are you a woman? I mean, he didn't look like anything anybody had ever seen. And he'd come out, scream one, and you knew everyone was supposed to, you know, just with that kind of enormous power. And if you read about any of the saints, you'll see that, of course, God is power. That is an aspect of the divine. So trying to hold it back is really keeping ourselves away from allowing divine energy to flow through us. And I think it's the hardest thing for people to know how to balance with power so that it doesn't take over our ego. It doesn't look too male, or it doesn't look like just gross assumption of power, because we've only related to it from an ego sense and not from a divine sense. Now, again, I know this story is common to a few people in this room, but it's really important to talk about it. It's a very fine line between the power of God flowing through us and ego. You've heard me say that a lot today. I started this talk by saying, these stories are not about me. Very tough to not let the ego get caught up here. But in the Bhagavad Gita, every character, which is the Hindu Bible, I imagine most of you have heard of it, And the two main characters in the Bhagavad Gita are Krishna, who is an avatar, and he was real. Krishna was a real being and essence in this earth. And Arjuna. And the Bhagavad Gita is tricky because part of it's true. The whole story takes place on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, and that place actually exists in India. But a lot of it is analogy, but the burning bush is an allegory. Thank you. I just couldn't think of the word. It's a lot of allegory. There is some analogy, but it's mostly allegory. So you don't know. This is one of those times where we've really been blessed because we had Yogananda here, and there's many tapes of him, and then we have Swami Kriyananda, who could interpret. It would be like sitting down and trying to read the Bible. I mean, how many people would understand what it was saying, really? So we have these interpretations of the Gita. Every character in the Gita represents a quality of each of us. So everything, I mean, every horse, every human being, one of the armies, the sort of bad army, is made up of thousands of people. And it's all of those qualities in us, those tendencies we have, those habits that we have that are kind of downward pulling, that keep us from letting energy rise and expand. Everything on the spiritual path, although it's not really linear like this, but everything on the spiritual path is about drawing energy in, up, and expanding. And you can just even see, I mean, we do these full yogic breaths. I was just doing it because I'm teaching meditation right now too. And you have people inhale, you know, and the beginning of the full yogic breath is like this, and then I said to everybody, stop. You can breathe where you are, but what does this feel like? Just to be like this. It feels big, it feels expansive, it feels receptive, it feels open. You know, this is the second time today, interestingly, that I'm referring to a position, but it's true. I keep getting back there because of what we're talking about. It's absolutely the truth. So everything on this spiritual path is about that. This is how we reconnect with the divine. We do not reconnect with the divine like this. You know, where is that? There is no magnetism in that, which means no energy is flowing. But when we're up and we're thinking up and feeling up and raising energy and thinking expansively, what else can I do? How can I bring these teachings into the world? How can I feel better, help other people feel better? Those are positive, great thoughts. They are what we would call dharmic. The word dharma in Sanskrit language means those things that you do or think or say that are right for the whole universe. No matter how they come through, they're going to serve everybody in a positive way. That's being dharmic. That which will lead you closer to God, to being one, to living purely in terms of these soul qualities. And they're always going to be good for the rest of the universe. So that's dharmic. And that's what this path is about, again and again. It's having us live more in terms of soul qualities and to remember. We don't have to learn anything. We simply have to put ourselves in a position to remember who we really are. So this young woman that I was starting to tell you about yesterday who came in and wanted to tell me, and she said, but you know, I just love her to death and I don't want to hurt her. This woman's wreaking havoc with her. This woman is basically in a manic phase of a bipolar disorder, unmedicated. And I'm saying that literally. So she's texting her every day, all day, for hours, texts are pouring in. She said it would be 15-page long letters. And she's telling her, this heterosexual, wonderful friend of mine, this other woman's, a patient of mine, telling her, and I'm in love with you, and you just don't know it yet, but you're in love with me. I mean, crazy. It's totally crazy. And my patient's saying, but I love her to death, and I don't want to hurt her, and what should I do? And I told you, sitting in my office like that, well, you know, you're going to have to actually own some of your power. Power that means truth. You're going to have to get next to it. Do you really love her to death? I said, first of all, what does that mean? You love somebody to death. But do you actually even really love her? Tell the truth, I said. Tell the real truth. She said, well, I do feel love for her in my heart. I said, okay, fair enough. does any part of you want her in your life? He said, no, it's killing me having her in life. Okay, how are we going to find a way to be honest with somebody who's psychotic? You know, it's interesting. It's not like you can say, look, I really want you to hear this. Let's get rational now. Let me explain. That usually doesn't work anyway when you're trying to tell somebody something they don't want to hear. Really, it doesn't. Often, we just have to be clear about where we are, hold the person in love, and then speak whatever truth we need to speak, or behave in ways that we need to behave, not with any meanness, not to hurt somebody, but is that serving anybody? And I thought to myself, she comes back, I'm going to tell her, and I mean this really, to start wearing some yellow on her all the time. I'm going to find out what the flower essence is for the third chakra. I'm going to find out what the sound is, the chord, because there's a chord for each. Chakras are energy centers that live in our, what is called, astral spine. I don't want to talk about them too much. But the third chakra represents power. And it's very important to try and get energy open and flowing there, because, first of all, we misbehave when it's not. We're either too powerful, we're either like Hitler, if we're imbalanced that way, or we're like my patient, if we're imbalanced the other way. And we all know there's something right in the middle. And what the middle looks like is when you sit and you talk to me, you feel some strength, and I'm very clear about what's okay and what isn't, what I'd like to do, when I wouldn't. I actually say yes when I mean yes, and I say no when I mean no, and I don't have to act out or get mean or crazy to do it. But I also don't have to live by presupposed notions of what's good, bad, right, wrong. So I can't do this because this might hurt this person. Therefore, I'll be dishonest, I'll suffer, and I'll really be hating her in my mind. Where's the good in that? So we have to find that place where we can be strong. Krishna said to Arjuna, when Arjuna said to Krishna, I don't want to fight this war. He was being asked, he was one of five brothers who were the good guys. They each represented a chakra. They represented all of the soul qualities within us, Arjuna being power. And all of these cousins. And he's saying, I'm not killing my cousins. I grew up with them. I loved them. They're like a part of me. We nursed at the same breast, he said. I'm not going to fight with them or kill them. And he throws down his bow and arrow, essentially saying, I quit, which is exactly what we do every time we say in life, I know that it would really be better to be honest with this person, or to maybe come to go meditate rather than going out for a few drinks with my friend, or saying, yes, I am going to meditate every morning. I'm going to make that a habit, even though the gym calls or my laptop calls or the phone's ringing or whatever it is, to really make a commitment. Those things are not easy. That's what I said before. The spiritual path is not easy. It takes commitment and it takes energy. It's not a passive act that we do to grow closer to God. We have to come to it with strength, with willpower, with commitment, with clarity. We have to be willing to fight the battle. Krishna says to Arjuna, you have to fight. You have to fight. First of all, there is such a thing as righteous war, God says in the Bhagavad Gita. Second of all, if you don't fight, if you don't take all of these qualities and run them through the third chakra, which you are, he represents it, represented by fire, therefore burning our, you could call them impurities, you can call them negative tendencies, negative habits. If you're not willing to burn that up so that it goes from the heat of this chakra to the heart, that it can flow up to the heart represented by air. So we go from fire, a physical quality. Before that it was water. Before that it was earth. Earth, water, fire, air. The first time in our spiritual lives where something can be expansive, where it's not existing in terms of physical, material, reality and boundaries. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's what happens as you move from the third chakra into the fourth. That's why it's fire and air. Krishna says to Arjuna, if you don't do that, he says everybody's life depends on it. The message being your whole spiritual life, the whole reason you're in a body, the whole purpose of life at all depends on you being willing to at times fight the righteous battle, no matter how hard it is. To own the power of God flowing through you, even at times if other people aren't going to like it, even if it's inconvenient for you, for any one of a number of reasons, if you actually want to keep taking this trip, the trip being up the astral spine, through the medulla, to the point between the eyebrows, which is the spiritual center in our bodies. This is how we see that, what's called the third eye, or the spiritual eye, represented by that five-pointed star. Okay? Just as you imagine Christ on the cross, or whatever. And that wasn't some artist's representation. When people actually see the light, that's how they see it, in deep, deep meditation. You see that star, and the minute you can go through that star, when our perception changes from this material reality to that reality. Oh, I forgot to wear my watch today. Is it 12 or 12:30?
12:30.
12:30. Wow. I'm bringing together light, the light of this Christ, center of Christ consciousness, third eye, spiritual eye. You know, this place in our body has great meaning, not just to people from Ananda, right? All Indians put kumkum there. That's where ashes go on Good Friday. People of all religions bless people here. Why is it? Because that's where we want our attention. Our energy goes where we bring our attention. So what we are trying to do is let energy flow freely up the spine, through the fire, be purified, own that power of the fire. It's fiery willpower is what it is. Move up into the heart where it can again be purified, so that we move from emotion to devotion to really knowing true love, which is divine love. And as much as we would love to feel that with another human being, it's a virtual impossibility. I don't, again, want to be negative. I'm not against loving people. And I know that people can love each other very well. That does exist. Not all that often, unfortunately, but it does exist. So I'm not, and I remember I said to you before, I'm blessed, I have a lot of love in my life. I don't want you to hear this as negative or that that's wrong. I want you to hear that it's on our way. It's not an end point. We get confused, and we're looking for that as an end point. And that's where we all get lost. Because we get there, and if we're honest, it's not very often that we feel really satisfied there. It is very seldom all we wanted it to be. Very seldom. Not never. Not never. It's interesting. We have a couple. They live in our community. So obviously they're both on this path. They've been on this path for years. They met in college. They left college. They went right to Fatmananda Village, and that was it. And they are, I think, completely and totally contented to be with each other. I'm sure they fight. I'm sure they struggle about some things. But it's not what is represented by their coupleness. They're perfectly happy. They couldn't imagine being with anybody else. They say this is extraordinary karma. This means I'm done with all relationship karma. It's perfect. But you don't hear that very often. You know, I mean, you just don't. My job is talking, actually listening to people. It's rare that people come in and say everything's perfect at home. You know, because it's not. And part of why it's not is because our expectations are off. And if our expectations are off, And we want that to fulfill us in a way that it can't, then it's never going to look right. You know, some time ago, there's a blog at Ananda.org, which is not our website, but the website of Menananda, called, what's the date of the light? What's the light one? A touch of light, yeah, thank you. So Jyotish and Devi, who are the spiritual directors of all of Ananda worldwide, really highly evolved, beautiful souls, both of them. If you ever want to go online and just listen to them or just see them, I mean, being in their presence, you feel what a blessing they are. They do a weekly blog. They keep it very short. You can sign up for it. It takes a minute to read. But deep spiritual truths and writing called A Touch of Light, and you can get to it right through Ananda.org. But some time ago, Devi talked, and I don't remember what the thing was about, and it doesn't matter what the rest of the writing was about, but she talked about the God hole in each of us. And it was very interesting. What she was really saying is, there is a place in all of us, and it's wrong to say those words, a place in all of us. For most of us, our experience is, there is this space that is only ever going to be filled by one thing that will have us go, ah, that's it, you know? I was watching my 18-month-old niece not that long ago trying to put squares in circles, you know, and it just doesn't fit. I mean, no matter how hard she tried, it just was not going to fit until ultimately she was screaming. I said to her mother, I think this toy's a little beyond her. But you know, in a way, I thought, that's what the God hole is about. The God hole is, we can look and look and look. We can try very hard to make relationships right. We can look for our true love. And I don't mean this to sound trite at all. We can get all the degrees we want. We can find the perfect house. I just met a woman last weekend. The whole story is relevant. I went up to be for a weekend with my friend who owns a home on Sea Ranch, who's dying. I don't think she'll live probably more than 6 or 8 weeks. Very, very dear friend who was diagnosed, total surprise, with gallbladder cancer. When she went in a couple months ago, she had her gallbladder removed, in and out surgery. Turned out it was a moment to tell her that she was not going to live very much longer. I went up to spend a weekend with her up at her place, and she said to me, because I'm her friend, I'm a doctor, I'm sort of managing her illness, her family, everything. I write a little blog about her every week so everybody can hear what's going on. She said, come to my knitting group, because these are the people who are going to be taking care of me, and they've all wanted to meet you, because we've heard a lot about it. So I go to her knitting group on Saturday, reminding myself, you're only here for her. You have nothing else to do in this moment. Sit in the knitting group. Ning's not my thing. But anyway, so I go to the knitting group, and I meet one of the last women I meet, and she says hello. And this is a true story again. These stories, when I'm getting ready to tell them, I think they're going to think I'm embellishing it, but I'm not. She comes over to give me a hug, and she bursts out crying. She just starts sobbing in my arms. Not the woman who's dying, but the knitting lady. And turned out to be a very sweet lady, actually, but so filled with sadness. I mean, just much of which she turns into anger. And I had the opportunity to tell her some of that before the morning was over. But she is telling me this story then, later, which she didn't tell me when she was sobbing in my arms. She told me she was sobbing in my arms because after getting Charlie Hebdo, it just happened that she was sad about the state of things in the world, she thought, or something. I think it was set last Saturday morning, so I think that had just happened. She was saying, oh, that made me so sad. 15 minutes later, she tells me, my husband and I have been together all of our lives. We finally come up to Sea Ranch and we build our dream house. We've been writing ideas for this house for 45 years, she says. And we build the dream house. And 6 months later, he's diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And 6 months later, he's gone. You know, they thought that that house was going to bring them joy, was going to give them the last little thing that they thought they wanted in the world. I mean, it's a terribly sad story. It really, and I said to her later, I think maybe you might want to think about where all the sadness is coming from. I don't think it's just about Charlie Hebdo, you know? That's sad, but But we all do that at certain points. Until we begin to live in terms of these soul qualities, so that we can say to ourselves, the love that I have with my husband or wife or friend or mother, it's pretty darn good. There's a lot here. And if I behave in certain ways, I can make it even better. But is it ever going to be that which will make me feel whole? No, because the God whole is always there. One thing that can fill the God whole, and that is moving back through the material world, through the energy, through the vibration, through the thought, to super consciousness. And every single thing that we do along the way, and this is really important, lest we feel that until we know any one of these things perfectly, what, are we just left here to suffer? No, we're not. Every time we say, yes, I will, let me go to another class, let me go home and see what is right about my husband or wife, let me go home to my parents, which has always been a trigger. Every time I walk in there, it's hard. You know the way I did it when I was young? And I didn't get this at all. The first thing I used to do is I travel to the East Coast and I get, when they used to sell these tickets where you could buy a ticket for one price. It's an airline that doesn't exist anymore. And you could fly as much as you wanted in a time period. But, you know, that obviously that doesn't exist anymore. But I used to buy those tickets. This just tells you how foolish I was. And I would go to see every relative and every friend and every one of my husband's relatives. We would go from place to place to place and fight with everybody. And I said, you know, honey, this is the third year we've done this. This is true. We fight with everybody. Could it really be everybody else? He got mad at me. But I said to him, you can be mad. We need to look at what are we doing? What are we bringing there? That we think we're so righteous, so self-righteous, we were going in trying to teach everybody how to live. That's what we were doing. We were the first vegetarians. We were the first ones who got off of refined foods. We were the first ones who learned about meditation. We were the first ones who understood what the Mandala Society of Holistic Health meant. For everybody, everything about how they had to live. My God, they were furious with us. You know, understandably. But that's what it's like. But every time that we say, let me get a little closer to love, let me come to a meditation even when I'm feeling a little lazy, let me be respectful of the other person that I'm living with, let me just say yes, okay, I'm not going to make a weekly commitment to go to a service or to come to chanting on Friday night, or if I say I'm going to do it every week, when I fail, it doesn't feel good. But let me, every time I say yes, no, because this is the truth. Remember, energy is magnetic. Every time we say, I will, yes, absolutely, to the right things, it's quintessentially different than saying, I won't, I'm not going to, I can't. Do you hear where those are? They're totally dead-end roads. They're totally feeding the devil, if you will. They're sinking us down this astral spine instead of up. It's not just the goal that we have to get to before we find or have any of these experiences. It's the path that we're willing to step on and walk. It's the path of moving up this spiral staircase that is our spine, that we awaken each time we agree to take any part of the journey. No matter how small it is, this is the truth. I know this to be the truth. When I told you I'm teaching Med 1 right now, and everybody comes thinking, I want to learn about meditation. I'm teaching it because it's January. I knew it would be a huge class because everybody's just made their New Year's resolution. Then they come to the first class, and they hear me say, this is hard. You have to put a lot of energy in to develop a habit of meditation. You do. It is not easy. Everything in us says, no, I'm not going to sit here. My body's saying to me, I'm not going to sit here with my legs crossed, my palms up, just sit perfectly still for the next, whatever, 10 minutes, 5 minutes, try it for 3 minutes. Your mind just going to say, oh, sure, I'll just go to sleep for a while while you, because you want your mind to be empty. It's not easy. But I say to them, do what you can. And don't let a morning go by in this month that we're taking this class, or an evening. If you can't actually sit down, go up to the little altar that you made, hold your hands in prayer position, and just prone on. If you even do that in ways that I don't have time to teach you, and I couldn't anyway, your whole world starts changing. This is the truth. This is not something that Shanti just believes in. Every time we turn in the direction of upward moving energy, of expansion, of heart opening, every time we do that, our lives change in ways that are, as it says in one of these lines from Master's poem, Samadhi, beyond imagination of expectancy. You know what happens when you bring one magnetic bar next to the other? And now that we have electron microscopy and you can see it, all those little electrons and protons, they just go just like that. That's literally what happens with magnets in an instant. That's what happens inside of us when we say yes, when we bring our attention to the point between the eyebrows, when we think about loving better, owning power. Just the fact that you're here means so much in your life. The fact that I'm here means so much in my life. And I get a few bonus points because I had to prepare a little. You guys just had to show up, you know? And I mean it. Why else do I teach? Why would I teach? Because every time I say yes to teaching, it takes me further down that path. It puts me right in the middle of that path. Instead of reading a novel or watching some television show last night, and I mean this, after I finished with a meeting about what Ananda Valley Farm is going to do at the Pumpkin Festival next year, but with what we call gurubhais, other people on the spiritual path, sitting and eating a dinner, talking about, and somebody said to us, somebody wrote us and said, look, what the, because it's about making money. We just bought this farm a year and a half ago and we needed to start making money. That's a beautiful farm. And right now I'm going to invite all of you to a day-long retreat that I'm doing with a man from Ananda Village next Saturday. You can come out. It's on our website. Actually, you'll get another mailing about it. Come to it. It's fabulous. Farm is fabulous. But this guy writes, and he's lived in half New Bay, like he said, well, here's what the food's got to be about. He says this to us. Now, we're vegetarian, and we all try and eat well, because food matters. Food is energy, right? I'm not saying that we don't enjoy dessert or slip off the wagon, maybe even a few times a day, but our effort and energy is in the right direction. We are there with a booth that's about our organic farm. He said it's got to be about fat, salt, and sugar. That's what he writes. And he comes up with a suggestion. So we see what everybody else has been doing for years at the Pumpkin Festival. Anybody ever been to the Pumpkin Festival? He's right. It's mostly fat, salt, and sugar, and there's a few turkey legs thrown in there and a couple pieces of sausage. And that's what it is. It's churros, it's everything is deep fried, everything. And they serve pumpkin pie. And they're going to kill me for this, but it's the truth. If anybody from Half Moon Bay listens, I'm sorry. They're not Half Moon Bay pumpkins. I probably should have meant to edit that out of here. But what I'm saying to you is we sat down at that dinner table and we said, but that doesn't represent who we are. We don't. I actually don't eat. I mean, I eat a potato chip or corn. We ate at a Mexican restaurant last night, so you know, I was eating salsa and chips, but I probably haven't eaten a chip for the last 6 months. I, as a rule, don't eat deep fried food. You know, why would I be standing there cooking it? I couldn't even imagine it. It was gross to me. So, and I started saying it to you though, because after that lovely meeting with those people where we were talking about staying in tune and in line with the teachings, and what could we make that would draw people and that they'd want to pay $5 or $6 or $7 for, but that we wouldn't be embarrassed about selling, you know, and wouldn't take us out of our spine to do that. Then I went home and I get to start preparing for this, sitting down, meditating, saying, so that the more and more and more of our lives that we spend in right attitude, in uplifting activities, then we just find that soon before we know it, we're just living from here, we're just moving from here. We are very different in the world And immediately people are different to us because they feel it. Things that would upset us, they just don't. It's not even because we have to try. It's like, oh, gee, I just spent an hour and a half getting to my dentist, sitting in the car waiting for them to open, and I walk in and she said, we have no electricity, we have nothing, we can't work on you, and we can't even reschedule you. Okay, get in the car, drive down through morning rush hour, run out of gas on the way. I mean, all this happened, like, but you know, it just, I mean, they sound, they're little things, right? But would most people feel they're little things? You'd be hearing about, like, God, I went to the dentist, it took me an hour and a half to get there, then it took me 2 hours to get home. It's all the truth. 101, 8 o'clock in the morning, you know? Then I ran out of gas. But then guess what? There was some lovely person there who said, well, there's a gas station right over there. Come on, I'll go get out, take this tank, fill it up, bring it back, be lovely. Wonderful, you know? And, I mean, it's just what happens. It's the goal. It's why we're here this time. We don't even know that some of the time. It is exactly why we came into these bodies, is to learn how to have experiences of these at any one of them. Because if you are love, if that's what you are, several years ago I did a month of seclusion. My mantra the whole time, I told somebody every day it was peace, it wasn't true. I didn't say I want to feel calm. For 1 month I said, I am calmness. Calmness is one of these. I am calmness. For a month, I was totally unplugged, totally. No phone, no television, no computer, no newspaper, no nothing. Me. I just had myself. That could be a challenge. I am calmness. I am calmness. And then you get through a month of that, you're calmness. You really, doesn't calmness in, it lasts very long, but you get there. You think, oh my God, this is what we can do. This is what we can do. It's remarkable. What else would we want to be doing? So, questions, comments, anything? Nothing? Or are you shy? You don't have to be shy. Yeah? If you think if we're good, I'm going to stop though. Okay? All right. Thank you all so much for being here. And I didn't even make you do, we were going to do the super conscious living exercises. You're going to have to be awake and ready and all that stuff, and we never got there.